How I Came to the Maharshi by P.V. Sastry. And quote, which is the greater miracle, to change the date on a tombstone or to change a man's heart? I mean, go to a doctor, live a few years, a year longer or something. Or go to a miracle, someone get healed. You know. That's all you're doing is changing the date on a tombstone.
Yeah.
In May 1945, my eldest son, who was 23 years old, married, devout, and a very promising young man passed away. The event was so terrible and caused such grief that it was thought I would not survive it. I neglected practically all my worldly duties for the saint for some time. Later, I was somehow attracted to Ramanashram and went there with the whole of my family. Ordinarily, people under such circumstances would go to obtain peace and get rid of their sorrow. But that was not the idea of myself and my wife. Having read about Sri Krishna's bringing Sandipani's son back to life, we were so mad as to think of getting our son restored to life by the grace of Bhagavan Sri Ramana. Have you read the Edgar Allan Poe's story, The Monkey's Paw?
I don't remember it.
I think it, well, that's the only thing I used to read when I was a kid. But they gave three wishes, a wish, and they wanted to bring his son back.
Oh, yeah.
And he comes out of the grave, but he's like, body's all decomposed. And then to send the boy back, you know. I mean, they use the three wishes in vain, you know. We were prepared to sacrifice our all for that. We left for Tiruvannamalai, and reaching the ashram at 11 a.m., entered the hall where Bhagavan used to sit. Our idea was to beseech him to bring our son back to life. But despite our intense desire, we found that we could not open our mouths to speak. We simply sat silent till Bhagavan rose for dinner and everyone went out. Then we too went back to where we lodged. We went again in the afternoon when devotees assembled in the hall with the same purpose, but the same result. And that way 8 days passed. Each morning and afternoon we wanted to implore Bhagavan to bring our son back to life, but we could not utter a word in his presence. On the eighth evening, we talked it over together and coming out of the hall and decided that it was no use staying any longer since our purpose had not been fulfilled. So we decided to leave the next morning. At that moment, a gentleman of the name of Subba Rao met us. He was formerly a pleader, I think, at Nellore and had come to Tiruvannamalai and settled down as one of the resident devotees. We had made friends, perhaps because I also am a pleader. He asked me what we were talking about, so I told him our whole story. I admitted that we felt peace in Bhagavan's presence, but the moment we left the hall, our grief burst out again like a volcanic eruption. And yet we were unable to speak out and put our desire before Bhagavan. Mr. Subba Rao promised to take us to Sri Bhagavan the next day and introduce us to him. We agreed, and next day, on being introduced, told Bhagavan about our grief, and in a general way, asked for his help. Sri Bhagavan nodded his head and said, "Sari, Sari, all right, all right." But we still found ourselves unable to talk anymore. still less to tell him what it was that we really wanted. Again, we felt constrained to sit there speechless. That evening, we decided to leave, since even the intervention of Mr. Subba Rao had not helped us. But Ramana would not let us go. The thought occurred to me that I should buy some books published by the ashram. So I went to the bookstall. The gentleman in charge was in meditation, but he opened his eyes immediately and asked us to come in. You know, like nobody goes to the bookstall. On being questioned by him, I repeated our whole story. He said that the Maharshi was capable of bringing the boy back to life, but since the boy was a highly religious and really devout young man, he would have gone to better regions and would not like to come back to us. I assured him that he loved us so much and we loved him so much that he would really come back if it were possible. The gentleman then put me another question. Suppose Bhagavan brings him back to you and then both of you die. What will the position be then? This question dispelled the thick cloud of illusion that had enveloped us, and at last we saw that our attempt to get our son back was sheer madness. I felt at the time, and still feel now, that it was not the bookseller that was talking to me like that, but really Bhagavan speaking through him. We abandoned the hope of getting our son back to life, and also our plan of leaving immediately. We stayed for about 12 more days, until our monetary resources were exhausted. The rest of our stay at the ashram was only for the purpose of obtaining peace. Sri Ramana's sari, all right, had been meant to help us in the only way which a realized guru would help. His grace was bestowed on us, and he began to work silently in our hearts to remove the thick clouds of sorrow and end the volcanic eruptions of grief. He began to instill peace and develop real knowledge in us. Silently and slowly, the grace is still working in that direction. What we wanted to have, we were actually prevented from asking for. We were also not allowed to go away in a mood of despair. We were blessed with his grace and uplifted in the right way. Because this is an experience of an extraordinary type, I feel that it is appropriate to make it known to all the devotees of Bhagavan. Number 3, by D. I first learned of Sri Ramana Maharshi when I came across the book A Search in Secret India by Paul Bunton in 1943 or 44. It made a tremendous impression on me, and I must have read it 3 or 4 times, but somehow it did not occur to me that I could go to Tiruvannamalai and meet Bhagavan in actual flesh and blood. Apparently I was not destined to, maybe because I was not mature enough. Next, I remember hearing about his Mahasamadhi in April 1950, when it was broadcast all over India. I felt very, very sorry that I had missed having his darshan. One day in 1961, I happened to visit a friend who had a very pious and devout lady staying with him. There was a small gathering there of people who had come to hear her talk on spiritual life. I also stayed to listen. The words that struck in my mind were, "Don't delay any longer. The time to begin your sadhana is here and now. It will be too late when you get old. Either you will not have the energy or ill health will prevent it. Don't put it off on the excuse that you are still working professionally or in business, or that you still have to arrange your daughter's marriages and get your sons fixed up in life before you can attend to anything else." I returned home in a very thoughtful mood. Sadhana meant for me Bhagavan. Fortunately, I had 1 or 2 books about him and his teaching, written by some of his old and devoted followers. I read and reread them, and was completely overcome. The direct method of self-inquiry, as explained in them, captivated me and would not leave me. I got all the books I could and went through them. And then the idea of visiting Sri Ramana Ashram arose in me. An article that appeared in a weekly paper about the continued spiritual life there converted the idea into a firm decision. I arrived there for the first time at the end of 1961, just after Bhagavan's Jayanti. Although it is said that Bhagavan's teachings are crystal clear and do not require any explanation, I would nevertheless submit that for a new sadhaka, especially a dunce like me, and one who has not sat at the lotus feet, at his lotus feet, books written by his old disciples are a great help in understanding the terse and incisive writings and sayings, at least in the early stages. Sri Ramana Ashram today has a very calm and peaceful atmosphere, and yet vibrant with power. I found it more conducive to meditation than any other place I know. The presence of Bhagavan is felt everywhere, and more strongly than I can say. In fact, I can fully endorse the poem by S.P. Mukherjee in the first issue of The Mountain Path, and should like to quote it here as saying what I want to say. A beacon still. We have not seen you, Bhagavan. We have not approached your lotus feet. Yet do we find the now and the then are the same for us. The body presence, the presence in the heart, these are the same. One thing only do we know. Ramanashramam is still a beacon. I was delighted to find that one is at perfect liberty to do what one likes there and not to do what one does not like. Non-compulsory ritual or discipline. There are certain rituals and pujas, but you are at liberty to attend them or not, as you please. In fact, you are left alone to follow your own path. That does not mean that no one is helpful. On the contrary, I found that the inmates and devotees are always willing to help when help is needed. Only they do not interfere when interference is not needed. There is a mysterious power that draws you to the ashram again and again. It is like a magnet. Each year now, I come back for as much time as my work will allow. Satori by F.O. Some years after Bhagavan left the body, his Jayanti was being celebrated on a roof terrace in Calcutta in the cool of the evening. Among the devotees present was a teenage girl on whose face, as she sat in meditation, an expression of radiant serenity was seen. Later, she put her experience in words so far as is possible. The following is what she wrote. I am not the mind nor the body. Found myself in the heart. That me that lives after death. There was breathtaking joy in the feeling I am. The greatest possible earthly joy, the full enjoyment of existence. No way to describe it. The difference between this joy and complete happiness of the mind is greater than between the blackest misery and the fullest elation of the mind. Gradually, rapidly, my body seemed to be expanding from the heart. It engulfed the whole universe. It didn't feel anymore. The only real thing was God, Bhagavan, Arunachala. I couldn't identify myself as any speck in that vastness, nor other people. There was only God, nothing but God. The word I had no meaning anymore. It meant the whole universe. Everything is God, the only reality. Mountain Path. Stillness by N.R. Krishnamurti. In stillness, the mind-body world complex dissolves. The ego has to be created, maintained, and then dissolved. And yet there is no ego to be dissolved. It does not exist. Neither do its shadows, mind, body, world. This is the ultimate truth revealed by the inquiry, who am I? Who would kick a shadow? It is said that the light and heat of Atma playing on the desert of Maya generates the mirage of the mind, body, world complex. Who is it that asks, who am I? Ask this, and the ego is nowhere at all. All that is pure. Being awareness bliss, I am, without beginning or end. And this forever is. This Arunachala Ramana Shiva Santam, the one without a second. Thought is no more. Even inquiry has exhausted itself. And one is still and abide as one is. The core of existence, the heart. The Heritage of Sri Maharshi by Moni Sadhu. Moni Sadhu is well known to many of our readers through his book, In Days of Great Peace, in which he describes his stay at Tiruvannamalai during the lifetime of the Maharshi and the enormous influence that the Maharshi had on him. More than 60 years ago, Swami Vivekananda expressed a far-reaching truth. A good thought, even when generated in a secluded cave, will invariably have its repercussions throughout the whole world. In other words, spiritual energy, like its junior sister, material energy, does not go astray or perish. At that time, the penetration of Eastern, especially Vedantic philosophy, into the Western world was only just starting. Vivekananda, with his worldwide traveling and lecturing about yoga, was one of the ablest exponents in his own day. Almost at the same time, in the silent caves of the holy mountain of Arunachala, a young ascetic, Venkataraman, the future great rishi of India, whom we know as Bhagavan Sri Ramana Maharshi, started his spiritual work for humanity. The potent current of meditation born from his state of true samadhi has since enveloped our globe. If a single thought leaves its impression on the mental aura of the planet, we can hardly imagine the actual result of a constant stream of spiritual energy, such as that which for more than 50 years radiated from Sri Maharshi. In the early part of this century, the central Vedantic teaching of self-realization as the goal of man's attainment was little known in the West, although it had continued in an unbroken stream in India, as well as throughout the Sufi saints of Islamic countries and the Buddhist masters of various schools. It was Sri Maharshi who made it known throughout the world in the form of the quest for the self. Acting for our present epoch as a supreme messenger of truth, Sri Maharshi gave new life to the ancient teaching, and by his own example showed to us that realization is possible here and now. Books giving the Master's teachings and commenting upon them are now spreading over the world. Little wonder then that those who are ripe for it and whose destiny draws them to the quest of realization respond and accept the teaching given for this epoch. Thus they gradually become able to perceive the inner light, the inner guru spoken of by the Maharshi. Very striking is another phenomenon. In letters from all parts of the world, I can see that people have found the teaching of the great Rishi and the idea of using the vichara to be something they already knew in their own depths. They often say that, after reading a few pages, development and understanding flow as if through a riverbed prepared long ago, and they find that the teaching belongs to them. Truth is not discovered, but recognized. There are also those who have not yet encountered any of the Maharshi's teachings or read anything about him, and yet of themselves speak to penetrate into their own mysterious inner realm in which to find the final enlightenment. They seek their self. We know that there is no such thing as a result without a cause. A potent cause must be behind the new trend in man's eternal search. To me, it is utterly clear. It is the spiritual inheritance from one of the perfected, from a life manifesting truth, a life which some of us were privileged to witness with our mortal eyes. The eye current to which the Maharshi teaching turns us works beyond the veil of religion. It reaches men of different denominations and speaks equally well to the Rishi's own countrymen, to Christians, Buddhists, Muslims, and others. Here we see another characteristic of the Master's inheritance. Sri Maharshi neither created nor propagated any new religion or philosophy. He did much more, giving us the key with which to open the hidden treasure of all true religions, to understand and then to practice them with inner enlightenment, and not with gloomy indecision, doubt, and lack of faith, as some may have done before. The Master ever abides with us, and his spiritual energy penetrating this world of relativity, as he told us before he left his body. The immense spiritual accumulator he charged during his visit to our planet as a living man assists and inspires seekers who are ripe enough to realize his teaching and message. From the Yoga Vasistha, that method by which a man makes spiritual progress is the best for him. He should not change it for another, which may not seem right to him or please him or be useful to him. Here's an article. The Lesser and Greater Jihad by Abdullah Qutbuddin.
That's the same as Arthur Austin.
I don't think he used that.
Yeah, he wrote under that name for Islam.
Well, he had a couple names.
Some Christian name to write for Christian.
The Futility of Argument, verses 196 to 803 of the Paramattaka Sutta, translated by Frank Allen.
What sutra? Anamika.
Parimattika Sutta. The person who is prejudiced in favor of one particular philosophical system is prejudiced against other systems. Such a person disputes and does not overcome the habit of disputing. He seizes upon anything that seems good, that looks good, sounds good, and particular actions that appear to him to be good, upon anything he thinks is good, and in so doing, he labels other things bad. Experts are agreed that the man who labels things bad is thereby making it impossible for himself to see them as they really are. Therefore, the disciplined one should not color what he sees and hears, nor pin his faith on virtue and achievement. He should not found or favor any organized system of philosophy, either by word or deed. He should not consider himself better or worse than another, nor equal. Being without prejudices and favor, uninfluenced by convention, he does not associate himself with any formal religion or sect. He is not bound by any set rules. For him, there is no need to strive to become this or that in this world or the next, and he has ceased to study the philosophies, for he no longer requires the solace that philosophy offers. As regards things seen and heard, he remains unswayed by prejudice. Such a Brahmin is not to be misled. He accepts nothing, prefers nothing, takes to no particular philosophy. Not on account of his virtues and achievements does the true Brahmin fare to the further shore, never more to return. Mary Biles writing about Zen training in Japan. I visited the monastery 3 times. The first was for a very elaborate ceremony at the commencement of the summer training period. All the Daitakuji priests came dressed in their splendid robes, and a few lay people as well as the monks. The Roshi preached a sermon to the shrine, not to the audience, ranged on each side. And once again, several bent over books and appeared to be taking the opportunity to make up for arrears of sleep. It was a very beautiful ceremony in the midst of austerely beautiful surroundings. The second time was for meditation in the shrine room, where lay people are not allowed to meditate with the monks in the Zendo. I was a trifle nervous because I had been warned that the monk who wielded Manchuri's sword to whack the meditators had a very heavy hand, and when over the age of 60, one's bones became brittle. The stick is not used in the European Zendo, though why I do not know, for it is used in all Zen monasteries of all Zen sects. Quote, "You have to be cruel to be kind," unquote. I was again told, the monks sit in lotus style on a high wooden platform on either side of the Zendo, and I could hear them being whacked. Carrying the sword of Mansuri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, the monk in charge cannot err, and the whacking is carried out with proper bowing and ritual. All the same, I was glad he did not come to the shrine room while I was there. Partway through the meditation session, the bell rang for Sazen, and monks and lay Europeans, trainees, lined up for interview with the Roshi. On 3 occasions, there was what seemed to be a frantic stampede among the monks. It was occasioned by a young monk being told to return to the Roshi's room, and being terrified to do so, blows and angry words was rained upon him to force him in, and one of the monks had to be taken by his leg and shoulders and thrust him.
This sounds like torture.
The last occasion I visited the monastery was to interview the Roshi. It took me 7 weeks of persistency before I was at length granted an appointment. I asked them, "Why are your disciples so afraid of you? You look smiling and gentle enough now." "Ah," he replied, "a teacher has to have two faces. You see my visitor's face, but my disciples see my teacher's face. I have to be stern to them. That is the only way they can learn." And so, in addition to the physical austerity, the monk must expect to meet mental and emotional cruelty deliberately inflicted. You and I can never see the Roshi's other face except in pictures. There was an especially striking picture on the wall screen of one of the Daitokuji temples. It showed a stern-faced Roshi with a sinister glint in his eyes and his sideways-looking eyes, and his stick uplifted. Slinking in the back was a pale, shrunken, and terrified monk. Even the convinced European trainee must expect for at least a year to feel his knees trembling each time he goes into the Roshi's small room. How much more the young Japanese, who must train only so as to become a temple priest. And then, at the end of it all, you will have found enlightenment. None of the Zen priests I met appeared to have outward signs of any deeper enlightenment than the average of one's well-intentioned friends at home. I often used to think of simple-minded Brother Lawrence, a cook in the Christian monastery, who merely practiced the presence of God. It seemed to me he probably knew more about Satori, enlightenment, and his original faith, quote-unquote, than Zen masters who found the answers to the 1700 koans. But what about the idea of the Western exponents of Zen, who say all you have to do is to be spontaneous, and then one day the Roshi twists your nose and you have realization? Well, that is just a Western idea. Westerners import some things that are not there. Now, leaving aside the Zen training, let us turn to the poetry and art and some of the pithy stories. I do not think Zen has anything to add to Mahayana Buddhism, Shintoism, or Taoism, but it has gathered wisdom from all these. And long after its training has been forgotten, some of its stories, its poetries, and art will live. Here is a story that might have come from the Buddha himself. It is of a nun going on a pilgrimage who came to a village at sunset. A nun would offer her a night's lodging. She went into the field and lay at the foot of a cherry tree. At midnight she woke and saw the cherry blossoms laughing to the misty moon. Overcome with the beauty, she rose and bowed towards the village, saying, "Through your kindness in refusing me lodging, I found myself beneath the blossoms on the night of the misty moon." And listen to some of the profound truth as well as beauty in the verses like these. "You remain silent, and it speaks. You speak, and it is silent. When you are not in antagonism to it, it turns out to be the same as complete awakening. The wild geese do not intend to cast their reflections. The water has no mind to receive their image." The same applies to Zen art and the ability of the artist to identify himself with nature. And then there is the superb symbolism of the ox herding pictures. The man catches sight of the tail of the ox, his own self. This is Satori. He follows it, tames it, rides it, loses both himself and the ox, and then returns to ordinary life, spreading a beneficence.
Brother Lawrence.
There's a book, The Practice of the Presence of God.
I'd like to read that again.
It's a little book.
Yeah, I read it, but I couldn't remember.
Yeah.
You must cling to T-O-O by Devraj Madhaya. In India, we compare the aspirant who strives to the child of the monkey that clings to its mother as she jumps from tree to tree, and the devotee who relies completely on the grace of the guru, to that of the cat that is quite helpless and is therefore picked up by its mother and carried in her mouth. Alluding to this, I said once that I was like the kitten and had cast the whole responsibility on Bhagavan. He laughed, but would not agree. He said, both are necessary. I will hold you, but you must cling too.
That's what I hear, right?
From the Yoga Vasistha, all the various doctrines and paths originating at different times and in different countries lead ultimately to the same supreme truth. Like the many different paths leading travelers from different places to the same city, it is ignorance of the absolute truth and misunderstanding of the different doctrines that causes their followers to quarrel in bitter animosity with one another. They consider their own particular dogmas and paths to be the best, as every traveler may think, though wrongly, his own to be the only or the best path. From the Ishva Upanishad, he who sees all beings in the same self and the same self in all beings does not hate anybody. When a man knows that all beings are ultimately the self and realizes this unity in experience, there remains no delusion or grief for him. And from Lala, a Kashmiri woman saint, I, Lala, wandered far in search of Shiva, the omnipresent Lord. After much wandering, I found him at last within myself, abiding in his own home. And Tulsidas says, many are the means of crossing the ocean of reincarnation, of which the pure words of the Vedas speak. But Tulasi says, real peace of heart cannot be attained without giving up the notions of I and mine. The Tearing of the Mask by Hirandyanath Chattopadhyaya. There comes a time, but do not ask, when since I know not, this I know and this only, that unto each one comes nemesis. What is nemesis?
The what?
Nemesis.
Nemesis. It's like the thing that will get you.
A sparkling night, naked with an excess of splendor, troubling hearts with loneliness, the jet-black diamond hour which tears the mask nature hath wrought with cunning, most intricate of mask, both you and me, self-invaders who keep running after brief thrills of time, from dusk till morning, from morn to dusk tide scorning, the taciturn rapture of eternity, that instant of unmasking is divine, and hence a seal of everlastingness, torture-packed instant on the angel's press, their heavenly weight, so man's dividing line. It's all one sentence. You know. Here's another article, Arthur Osborne. Many are called, but few are chosen. He says Sagittarius. He uses that.
Yes.
I have a tribute to Sai Baba. The author of this article gives little factual information about Sai Baba. In India, he is so well known that it is not necessary. Foreign readers can refer to the incredible Sai Baba. Briefly, he was a great saint, living at the turn of the century, died in 1918. He had both Hindu and Muslim disciples refusing to say that he belonged to either religion. He wrote nothing, which is perhaps why he is so little known outside India, but worked an extraordinary profusion of miracles. Like the Maharshi, he appointed no successor, but remained himself the guru after death. He still appears in dreams and visions to those who turn to him with true devotion, answers their prayers, cures sickness, grants boons, removes obstacles. This explains why, with no organized propaganda and no institution in his name, the devotees are far more numerous now than in his lifetime. Now he's the most popular guru in the world.
Yeah.